Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor John Davis with an amazing story about the unlikely Jewish converts of San Nicandro, Italy. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. What do you think is the essential Jewish characteristic? Is it the ability to survive, as we've been doing for 3,800 years since the days of Abraham and Sarah? Is it the enjoyment of food, without which no event seems truly Jewish? Is it our profound and ancient commitment to learning that is our most unique quality? Or is it the willingness to argue that makes us truly Jewish? You know the stereotype. When you have two Jews, you have three opinions. We have developed over the millennia a remarkable talent for disagreement. And that is reflected in everything from our taste in synagogues and Jewish food to our Talmudic literature. What is the Talmud really but a very long, extended argument? There is the classic Jewish joke about the desert island. A ship is sailing in a lonely part of the South Pacific when the captain sees smoke coming from what should be a deserted island. He steers for the island, and as he approaches it, he's startled to find that there's actually a full pier and a well-dressed man waiting on the beautifully built dock. The captain crosses the gangplank and is welcomed by a guy who says his name is Goldberg. "I'm astonished, Mr. Goldberg," the captain says. "How'd you get here? And how did you construct this magnificent dock?" "Oh," says Goldberg, "I was shipwrecked here alone 5 years ago. But the dock is nothing. Come, see the rest of the island." So Goldberg leads the captain on a tour. It includes a beautifully paved main street. He made the cement himself from seashells and coconut milk, a store, a school, every possible convenience. The captain oohs and ahs, but what really impresses him are the two magnificent buildings at the end of the street, both with stained glass windows. "My God, Goldberg, look at what you've done here with nothing but your bare hands." "But I'm curious," said the captain, "what are those two incredible buildings?" "Oh," says Goldberg, "those are synagogues." "It's incredible," the captain says, "amazing. But why do you need two of them?" "Well, the one on the right is my shul," says Goldberg, "and the one on the left I wouldn't be caught dead in." You may not realize that this tendency to argue is also quite ancient, dating back to the very first Jew, Abraham, who in this week's Torah portion of Vayera teaches us something central through the medium of argument. In our portion last week, Lech Lecha, Abraham was called by God to leave his homeland and journey to an unknown land. Atypically for all the Jews who have followed him, he did so unquestioningly, taking a great leap of faith into a new and strange place, trusting God to bring him to his destiny without questioning. But that's not the whole story, and in this week's portion of Vayera, things are different. Our Torah portion includes the remarkable tale of the impending destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, a traumatic decision by God to try to eradicate evil from the world. In one of the great short scenes in all biblical history, God tells Abraham of his plans to destroy the wicked cities, which were sort of the Las Vegas and Atlantic City of their day. Instead of nodding politely and accepting God's decision, Abraham nobly strides forward and protests, and he does so with another one of the great Jewish qualities, chutzpah. "What if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom? Would God destroy the city then?" Abraham asks. "Wouldn't that be immoral, the judge of all the world acting unjustly? Hashofet kol haaretz lo yaaseh mishpat?" God agrees with Abraham's objection, but the noble Abraham keeps arguing. "What if there are 45 righteous? 40? How about 30? Perhaps God won't destroy Sodom for the sake of 20 righteous people. 10, a bare minion. And so God agrees that even 10 would be enough to save the cities. Of course, there aren't 10 who are righteous. For a minion, you don't go to Sodom. And the fleshpots of evil are marked for destruction. But it is Abraham's noble defense of what might just turn out to be a righteous remnant that stands out. For this is the essential way all Jews ever since have interacted with God. We question and struggle. We test God, always seeking greater justice in the world. We argue with God and become holier and better people through that process. Pirkei Avot, the great ethical tractate of the Mishnah, tells us that Kol Machloket L'shem Shamayim, every argument that is for the sake of heaven, will yield lasting benefit. That is, if we argue as Abraham did for the sake of justice, holding even God to a higher standard, then we are being the best Jews we possibly can be, and thus the best human beings we can be. In this election season, in which moral arguments are few and far between, and the truth seems to be hard for candidates to hold on to, we know that we must strive for a higher standard. When we Jews argue against immorality in the world, in Pakistan's treatment of its schoolgirls, for example, or against the environmental destruction of our planet, or in favor of the rights of the downtrodden, like the immigrants, or the unemployed, or the medically uninsured, or the homeless, or the mentally ill, we continue what Abraham began in this week's Torah portion all those centuries ago. These are machlokot l'shem shamayim, arguments that are truly for the sake of heaven. And when we make these kinds of sacred arguments, our lives can, like Abraham's, bring great blessing. And then, as the Torah tells us, we too will become a blessing to all the families of the earth. So may it be. To play us in this beautiful fall morning, here's a lovely Sephardic song, a Tzur Mishelo, a Shabbat Zmirah, a melody sung around the Sabbath table, as sung by cantor Alberto Mizrahi.
Tzur Mishelo Achanu, Tzur Mishelo Achanu, Tzur Mishelo Achanu, Marech Ve'onai, Savanu Ve'otarnu, Savanu Ve'otarnu, Savanu Ve'otarnu, Ki Kvar Amonai, Azaret Ulam Oroenu Avinu, Achalnu Et Ilachimu Ve'yeno Shatinu, Al Ken
That was Tzur Mishelo from cantor Alberto Mizrahi from the Spirit of Jewish World Music CD. Our guest this morning, the fine historian and professor John Davis, has explored and written about a nearly unbelievable tale of Southern Italians who converted to Judaism at the least likely time in one of the least likely places. Find out how it all happened and the surprising turns of events that it created when we return on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. The other day I was writing up copy for a poster that shows Mama's new feature of the month. It's called Chicken Alfredo Pasta. This is what I wrote. Our Chicken Alfredo Pasta is fresh chicken breast sautéed in olive oil with al dente rotini pasta smothered in our signature Alfredo sauce and seasoned with our imported grated Italian Parmesan cheese. It's served with your choice of garlic toast or bread. Mangiamo. Now, the word mangiamo means eat up in Italian. And believe me, once you see our chicken Alfredo pasta, you'll definitely want to mangiamo. At Mama's, we're always trying to create delicious, unique, and value-priced entrees, appetizers, and desserts. Of course, our pizzas and calzones are always a favorite, but we hope you'll be adventurous and try some of our other great selections, too. I know they'll make you feel meraviglioso, which of course means wonderful. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor John Davis. He is the Emiliana Pasca Noether Professor of Modern Italian History at the University of Connecticut and the author of the fascinating book, The Jews of San Nicandro, about one of the most unusual conversion experiences maybe in all history. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about how you wandered into this experience and writing about the Jews of San Nicandro.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation to be on your show, and I'm really glad to have the opportunity to share this experience with you. It's a story I came across, I have to say, when I was still in graduate school, and I came across a reference to a group of Italian peasants who, in the early 1930s, had decided to convert to Judaism. And there was no real explanation, and I just found this really strange and curious, and this was a long while ago, and the story had been just at the back of my mind for a long time, and then I discovered that it was far from unknown. Other people had written about it at various points, but none of the explanations that I came across seemed to make any sense. So at a certain point, I'd finished writing a book about something completely different, and I thought, let me see if I can find out something about what this was all about. And that was how it started.
You know, I don't know why you would be surprised that a group of rural peasants in southern Italy in the middle of Mussolini's time, when fashion was on the rise, would suddenly decide to convert to Judaism. Why would that surprise you?
Because it made no sense to, first of all, one would have to understand how these people got to know about Judaism. I mean, after all, this was a society which most people tell us the majority of the population were illiterate. They couldn't read. They have very little knowledge of what was going on anywhere in the world. And there was no presence. There was no Jewish community anywhere nearby that any of them could have had any contact with. I mean, at the point when this story started, which was in 1930, Mussolini's regime had was in fact pro-Zionist. It was not initially an anti-Semitic movement, unlike the Nazis. But this was not really an issue for anybody in Italy, except for Italian Jews. Certainly not for these people that I found myself exploring. They were very, very poor, really very marginal people. So, you know, the fact that they got the idea in the first place is the big mystery, that they were able to follow it up initially under the fascist regime was not so strange, although after Mussolini's racial laws of 1938, the situation changed drastically.
Fascinating, a really extraordinary story. We will talk much more with Professor John Davis about the Jews of San Nicandro and a remarkable charismatic guy named Donato Manduzio, and find out why they decided to become Jews and what happened to them when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio at Yahoo. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website by streaming them or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And now here is our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moment. Israel, a heated issue throughout this presidential campaign, took center stage at the final presidential debate last week. The Jewish state was mentioned a total of 29 times by President Obama and Republican nominee Mitt Romney at the foreign policy debate in Boca Raton, Florida. You know, somebody actually counted 29 times. Real policy differences, however, seem to be in short supply in spite of there being a lot of heat at that debate. Israel and the Iranian nuclear program were among the main topics in a debate that largely focused on the Middle East, but whether the subject was Iran's sanctions, the need to stop Iran from going nuclear, or the deep U.S. commitment to Israel, both candidates sounded surprisingly similar notes. There were tactical political reasons why Governor Romney wanted to create the impression he is a centrist, said Aaron David Miller, a former top Middle East negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. But I think we are faced now, for the first time since the end of the Cold War, with a consensus on what we can do in the world. The public understands we need to fix America's broken house, but we are also stuck in a region of the world we can't fix or extricate from. The sharp policy differences might have been missing, but both candidates painted their support for Israel in personal terms. Romney talked about his close friendship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Obama talked about how he was affected by his 2008 visit to Israel, his stops at the National Holocaust Memorial of Yad Vashem and the embattled town of Sderot. Basically, there aren't really substantial differences between Romney and Obama and their commitment to Israel. Because in America today, you can't even become a major party serious candidate for president without being strongly dedicated to the close alliance between the United States and our best ally in the most volatile region in the world, the Middle East. And that is Israel. That was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. As they say in Chicago, vote early and vote often. We are delighted to welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Welcome.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Well, this will come as no shock to anybody who's followed Israeli politics. There's going to be early elections. That is, the Knesset won't fulfill its term. The prime minister will in some way or another be up for re-election. Tell us what the heck's going on. In America, it happens every 4 years. We spend trillions of dollars, and we kind of know how it works. But we don't really understand Israelis. The whole Knesset process. Can you explain it?
I can try. I must admit, even Israelis don't always understand Israelis. In Israel, the system is slightly different than here. Well, not slightly. It's significantly different. Officially, every 4 years, there should be elections to the Knesset, to the parliament. The voters go to vote, and they choose a party. They don't choose a person. They choose a party. When the votes are counted, those votes are translated into seats in the parliament. We have a total of 120 seats in the parliament. You take the number of votes that were given, divide them by 120, and then you know how many votes you need per chair in the parliament. After the parliament is defined, you have exactly how many seats each party got, then the president, in this case, Shimon Peres. And in Israel, the president is more of a symbolic
figure. Right.
He doesn't have a lot of authorities. He basically have two main authorities. One is to get recommendations from the heads of the parties on who should be the prime minister and assign the prime minister the mission to build a government.
Right. Like what happened with Tzipi Livni, but she couldn't put together the coalition, and then it became Netanyahu.
Correct. Basically, the president will seek to hear recommendations out of 61 parliament members or more about
because
a certain
61
person.
Is the bare majority of the 120-person
exactly.
Knesset.
Okay. Without having a majority in the parliament, the government will not be able to pass any laws and will not be able to govern, basically. The other authority the president has is regarding prisoners. He's the only one
commuting sentences,
exactly.
That sort of thing, right?
So all the heads of parties goes to the president. They give him his
recommendations. He lives in a nice house, though, the president. It's a very beautiful residence.
And you can go and visit.
You can visit.
And then he assigns someone to build the government, the prime minister. That person gets 2 weeks period to bring his government to the parliament, and the parliament needs to vote with a majority in order to approve the government. And once it's approved, then that's it. What usually happens politically is that each party after the election is starting to play the political game of what positions will our party members get in the government, what budget will be, will we be the minister of
education, right, transportation, whatever, infrastructure,
security.
Something.
Security. Of course, there are some ministers that are considered more respectful or more proceed or, you know,
prestigious. Defense minister is such a big deal. Defense, often the prime minister does
economics,
that too.
Right. Those stuff are considered more.
Foreign ministry.
There is also some invention that was created in Israel because of the need to give a lot of jobs to those parties, which is like a minister with no title.
Minister without portfolio.
Exactly.
You just have a staff. You don't actually have a job.
You have a staff. You take money out of the budget of the, you know, the government budget, and I don't truly know what you do. I don't think anyone knows what you do. But that's how it goes.
All right, well, so we'll talk next week about how come you sometimes have early elections in this complicated process. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we're now a couple of weeks removed from the last of the Jewish fall holidays, which sometimes means that we're a couple of weeks removed from our New Year's resolutions and our tshuva and all the great goals we had. Part of thinking about things in the longer term, whether it's international or personal, is looking ahead, scouting out. We started to talk a little bit about sacred discontent and trying to chart a path towards continuing in the year to try to make this a better world.
Right. So one commentary I read during the season said that, you know, when there's a discussion in the Talmud between rabbis who say when you get to the gates of heaven, the question you'll be asked isn't how many good deeds did you do or what kinds of sins did you do or did you repent? It will be, did you actively anticipate redemption? Did you actively do something to anticipate the construction of a better world?
To bring redemption.
Right. And so, I mean, the very interesting thing is that the Hebrew word is tzipita, which could be, did you expect? Did you hope for? Or did you scout out in the sense of, did you find a path? The scouts are called sofim, same root. And there's a notion that when we say the sort of almost trite phrase at the Seder that people question, like, why do we say this next year in Jerusalem? We could be in Jerusalem.
L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim.
Right. We could be there.
I've been there. Right. On Pesach.
Okay. So question is Jerusalem a metaphor? And if so, how does each of us define our own Jerusalem? And how do we define our own path towards our own Jerusalem, or towards a collective Jerusalem for the Jewish people, or for the entire world, for all of humanity? And I think that there's an implicit challenge that's pretty tough, actually, in that saying, next year in Jerusalem, because first the challenge is to define Jerusalem, and then it's to scout out the path that will move us, if not all the way there, at least closer to our own definition of Jerusalem. And that makes, for me, that thought makes this whole season of introspection and repentance or return, it's not just about the honey cake and the shofar and apologizing. It's also about scouting out a path forward to a goal or a destination that each of us has to define for himself or herself.
It's a great message, and it's a good one to remember, not only in the holiday season, but now as we're past the holiday season, you know what? All year, every day is a good day to look at what you're doing and improve.
I think so.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Irwin and Murray, Schmata businessmen through and through, celebrate selling their ladies' wear company at a big profit by going on safari in Africa. One night in the jungle, they freeze in their tracks when they hear an ominous low roar. Murray, quakes Irwin. I heard, shivers Murray. Shah, look behind me. Tell me what you see. A lion? A tiger? A leopard? I should know, moans Murray. What am I, a furrier? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayera, which includes the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, in which God tests Abraham by having him almost, but not quite, sacrifice Isaac on a rock. Famous for being read on the first day of Rosh Hashanah by Reform Jews and on the second day by conservative and Orthodox Jews, its connection to Rosh Hashanah would seem to be the fact that a ram appears at the end of the story, caught in a thicket by its horns, the model for all future shofars. But this passage, taken from the Torah portion of Vayera, is much more than a mere animal story. Cryptic, yet oddly repetitive, it raises a host of painful moral dilemmas and challenges us to think intensely about just what our relationship with God really is. According to the text, God tests Abraham, Adonai Nisayet Avram, by commanding him to sacrifice his son, his only son, his beloved son Isaac. This triple identification of Isaac mirrors an earlier command in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha to Abraham to begin his great journey towards God and monotheism. Leave, he was told, leave your land, leave your birthplace, leave your father's home. Now, also in triplicate, he's being told to kill his son, his only son, his beloved son. There are problems in the text. Abraham has another older son, Ishmael. So Isaac is not truly his only son. In fact, Isaac is actually the son of his older age with his wife Sarah. And Isaac is Sarah's only son. Clearly, all God needs to say here is take your son Isaac and there'll be no doubt who is intended for the sacrificial altar. Why all the extra language? A messy passage. But the biggest problem is the simple fact that Abraham, who has previously shown a tendency to argue and even fight injustice, obeys this terrible command and does so with apparent relish. He doesn't make a peep, doesn't say a single word of objection to God. In fact, we are told he gets up especially early in the morning to fulfill this horrible command of God with energy. The narrative itself sets up the drama beautifully, painfully, tragically. Isaac, who doesn't know what is being set up, goes along with his father. The phrase, the two walked on together, is repeated, and Isaac asks, where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham replies, correctly but ironically, God will provide. It is a weird and deeply troubling scene. And then, as Abraham is about to slaughter his son, an angel of God does intervene, and the murder of the innocent, the sacrifice of Isaac, is stopped. Isaac lives. And the future of our people, Abraham's children, is preserved. The story in its place and time was undoubtedly a polemical tale designed to teach the prohibition of human sacrifice. Children are not meant to be slaughtered on the altar of their parents' beliefs. God does not want the blood of the human lamb. Our Lord does not truly desire the destruction of his own children. In fact, Abraham's rush to fulfill God's weird and painful command to kill his son reminds us that we can embrace morally bad decisions with great fervor sometimes. And many, many times in human history, we have sent our children off to die for causes that were far from ethical. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen paraphrased this theme in his piece, The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went, and took the fire with him and a knife, and as they sojourned, both of them together, Isaac, the firstborn, spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps, and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son, when lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him, thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns, a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not do so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. Like the Europeans of Wilfred Owen's time, we still engage in such choices today. And like Abraham, we often fail the test. May we learn from this Akedah of Abraham's to choose life and not sacrifice for our children. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, historian John Davis, author of The Jews of San Nicandro, will continue the amazing tale of the Jewish converts of southern Italy who became Jewish out of religious commitment during Mussolini's regime, survived Nazi occupation, and after liberation and the end of World War II, formally converted, finally, to Judaism. It's a wild and weird story. Hear all about it when we come back on Two Jewish in just a moment.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
According to a new study, 97% of U.S. and Canadian college campuses report no anti-Israel or anti-Semitic events, and the campus-based anti-Israel divestment movement has failed. The American Israeli Cooperative Enterprise released the findings of its new study, Israel on the Campus, The Real Story, last week. Mitchell Bard, the AICE's executive director, and Jeff Dawson, the private organization's campus liaison, authored the report. Student Jewish groups are beating back such efforts, according to the authors, because of professional guidance provided by Campus Hillel's and numerous other Jewish organizations, while the anti-Israel efforts are largely student-led. Bard and Dawson tracked 674 anti-Israel events at 108 U.S. and Canadian universities during the 2011-2012 academic year. One-third of the incidents took place on just 10 campuses, four in the University of California system. Several of the campuses, the report said, have strong pro-Israel groups and cannot be characterized as hostile to Israel. Two anti-Israel groups, the Muslim Students Association and Students for Justice in Palestine, were responsible for most of the episodes. While two American universities did adopt divestment resolutions as part of the anti-Israel boycott, sanctions, and divestment campaign, the BSD it's called sometimes, many others were defeated. No American university has actually divested from Israel thus far, and prominent campus presidents have said they will oppose such efforts. Rather than weaken the relationship between U.S. colleges and Israel, the BDS movement has largely backfired. Ties are stronger than ever and continue to grow, the authors wrote. In much worse news from Europe, an Israeli flag was burned in front of a famous Budapest synagogue. The incident occurred last week in downtown central Budapest in front of the fabulous landmark Dohain Street Synagogue. The Israeli flag reportedly was desecrated by members of Jobbik, an ultra-rightist Hungarian political party taking part in commemorative events recalling the Hungarian anti-communist revolution of 1956. The leader of the Jobbik party, Gábor Vona, criticized cooperation between Hungary and Israel. He said the agreement between Hungary and Israel should be canceled. Israeli ambassador to Hungary, Ilan Mor, reacted to the anti-Israeli criticism of the ultra-rightist anti-Semitic party, demanding that Hungarian democratic forces should refuse this unacceptable anti-Israeli act and criticism. In other news, in Israel, more than 70 rockets and mortar shells fired from Gaza hit southern Israel in just one day last week, striking several homes and injuring three people. Four Palestinians were killed in Israeli strikes back at Gaza sites that were used for launching those rockets. The Palestinian Ma'an news agency identified the dead as members of terrorist organizations. The Palestinian terrorist explosives scored direct hits on at least five private homes. Three Thai workers also were injured, two of them seriously. The Iron Dome missile defense system, funded by the Obama administration, intercepted seven rockets aimed at Ashkelon and blew them up. Schools were closed in much of southern Israel, with the Home Front Command telling residents living within 10 miles of Gaza to remain near bomb shelters. Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, and the Popular Resistance Committees both claimed responsibilities for the rockets and mortars. The escalation on Israel's southern border came after an attack on an Israeli patrol near the security fence with Gaza earlier the week seriously injured a soldier from the Givati Brigade. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Do Jewish our guest this morning, Professor John Davis. He's Emiliano Pasqua Noether Chair in Modern Italian History at the University of Connecticut, a leading authority in the history of modern Italy. He's published widely on Italian history since the 18th century, including the prize-winning book Naples and Napoleon, Southern Italy and the European Revolutions. His book, and really a fascinating book it is The Jews of San Nicandro, about a small group of Italian, basically peasants, who in the 1920s and 30s, ultimately decide they want to be Jewish. Tell us a little bit about the leader of this group, Donato Manduzio.
Manduzio is the key to much of the story. He's, during the period that I was working on this book and researching it, I spent a lot of time with this guy. He was born around 1890, very poor background. We don't know anything about that really, but his biography begins to pick up with the First World War. He was drafted. He served in the Italian army, and then he got sick. And we don't quite know what this disease was, but it left him pretty much a cripple. And it was while he was in the military hospital in before he was discharged that he learned to read, and he became an avid reader. So when he went back to his village, this was down in the south of Italy in the Gargano, he, because of his disability, he couldn't work in the fields, and so he spent a lot of time reading. And at that point, there was no indication that his interests were religious. He was a great reader of melodramas and stuff like that. And then at some point, he got really seriously interested in religion.
You know, I was thinking there were two areas that were extremely interesting. The first was the reaction of the organized Jewish community in Italy, which goes back 2,000 years and is very traditional in many ways, although very diverse too. They were not totally sure what to make of these 12 or 14 families that had converted to Judaism almost out of nowhere.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that fascinated me one of the many things that fascinated me about this story is how did these guys, having decided to become Jews, how did they make contact with the Jewish communities in Italy? They had no idea where to start, and they sat down one day and they just wrote little postcards, and they sent these postcards in the mail to just about every city, and just addressed to His Worship, the leader of the Jewish church in Milan or Rome or whatever. So one of these postcards turned up on the desk, and that's a miracle too, on the desk of the chief rabbi in Rome.
Right.
And the correspondence has survived. I mean, he sent it across to one of his colleagues and said, well, what do you make of this? And the guy wrote back and said, well, it's probably some kind of practical joke.
But it wasn't a practical joke.
It wasn't a practical joke. I mean, they were Manduzio, and by then he'd got this small group of followers. And one of the things that I would love to have been able to find out more about is what it was that motivated these other people to take this very unusual step converting, because they had no contact with established Jewish religion or practice or whatever, they had no idea that you couldn't just wake up one morning and say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to change my name, I'm going to take a Jewish name, my wife will take a Jewish name, we've read the Torah, we've read the Pentateuch, and, you know, we're going to be Jews. And it took years for it really to get through to Manduzio that it wasn't up to him to decide, and he never really accepted that. In the correspondence that goes on through the 1930s, the rabbis in Rome keep saying, "Well, you know, we accept that you guys are serious. We accept that you are really highly motivated, but this is a difficult business, and our religion doesn't seek to proselytize. You know, a person comes, wants to convert, we will send them away up till seven times. So you've just got to be patient." And then Manduzio replies, "Well, what do you mean patient? I had a dream. God told me in a dream that I was to bring the Jewish religion to this God-forsaken, unenlightened corner of Italy. Who are you to tell me that I should be waiting when the Almighty has told me, you know, I've got a mission?"
Fascinating. There's another really dramatic moment when in the course of World War II, the Italians begin to fold, the Germans come and occupy Italy, or a Nazi officer actually, does he come into Manduzio's home? I mean, it's a very dramatic time. It could have really been the end for those families.
Yes, and it's not really at all clear how they, why these German officers, I mean, you know, this was just about 2 months before the Allied landings in September 1943. I think it was July. Southern Italy was not, you know, occupied, but these were German military forces that were coming down in preparation for the Allied landings. And staff car stopped outside Manduzio's house, and these three German officers wandered in. Well, they couldn't have been left in any doubt as to the environment, because it was full of Jewish symbols, religious insignia, and so on. And they were there for about 20 minutes, and then they came out, and apparently they just strolled down the street and smoked a cigarette, got back in their staff car, and went away. And that was, nobody heard any more about it.
So somehow or other, many of them did manage to get to Israel. Although it's interesting, I just saw an article not very long ago, last week, that said that now the Jewish communities are beginning to flourish again in that area. Obviously, some of them stayed behind.
Yeah, well, you're probably talking about the article that appeared in Haaretz last week, I
That's
think.
Correct.
What happened in 1949 was Manduzio died at the beginning of 1948, 2 months before the founding of the State of Israel. And then once Israel had become a reality, the possibility of emigration was real, except that, you know, at that point, there was something between 20, 25,000 European Jewish refugees in transit camps in different parts of Italy, people who had survived the Holocaust and had fled from Germany and Eastern Europe at the end of the war. These 25,000 Jews who were waiting to have the opportunity to emigrate to Israel, and so Manduzio's followers were, you know, they were way down the list of priorities. So it took a long time to find some way of getting them to Israel. But the older ones, many of the older ones, stayed behind. They didn't go to Israel, and their descendants are still there in San Nicandro today. I met them when I was working on the book. They were extremely helpful. They provided me with all sorts of information, and I got to know them. They're really charming people. They were very, understandably, I think, sort of cautious. They wanted to know why I was interested in them, why I was interested in their story. They didn't really want to attract attention. They said that, you know, a lot of people had came to find out about the background, and often they felt as though they were being treated as some kind of freak show or whatever. And that was one of the reasons that I deliberately, in my book, I didn't go beyond 1949, 1950, because I thought after that, really, it's their story. I had done what I could do as a historian using the documents I found, but it was up to them to tell them the modern story. And now it seems that this modern story, you know, is taking off again.
Fascinating.
Which is extraordinary. But I think most of the enthusiasm is actually, from what I've been able to pick up, is from other Jewish communities in southern Italy, where there were many Maranos from the 16th century on.
Anusim, hidden Jews, secret Jews, right?
Yeah.
Very interesting. I want to thank John Davis for a great visit. It's a fascinating story. The book's called The Jews of San Nicandro. Thank you, John, and appreciate the visit.
Thank you very much for your interest.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Michael Bar-Zohar and Nissim Mishal, authors of Mossad, The Greatest Missions of the Israeli Secret Service. Our playout this morning is the classic Yiddish song Rabbeinu Tam, as sung by Julie Jacobs. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
horses like